Feeling lonely.
Yeah.
I feel as though you should be taking it soon. Authority and all that. Okay, if we can pass, if I split these and we pass them around. Okay. I do hate it when I go somewhere and take loads of notes and then somebody says all those handouts afterwards. Oh, Dad. Not everyone likes the same approach, but I like full text and then I can annotate and scribble, doodle, put question marks, whatever I want to. So that's what I've done here. I then spoke to my daughter-in-law who said, oh, I don't like doing that. I like just taking notes fresh, but there we are. So this will be the basis of what we're talking about. If I tell you a little bit about myself, because I don't know most of you, and that means that you probably don't know me either. First of all, I feel that there are probably people sitting in this room that are much better qualified for taking this than I am. The only advantage I feel that I have over you is age for most of you. But in terms of knowledge, I'm sure there are things that you will contribute, and I would like you to, because that would be very helpful to me. It's not the first time I'm going to be doing this. I'm a wife and a mum to three children, the youngest of which is nearly 19 now, and then we've got 24-year-old and 26-year-old, and we have a granddaughter. So I have a vested interest in this particular subject. But it's also one that has occupied my thoughts a lot over the years. First of all, as a teenager, I was Christian then, and a lot of the stuff that impacted our culture was impacting then, and so I was trying to think then, well, how does this fit with what I actually believe? Is there a framework that I can use to actually help? Then later on as a wife and later on as a mother. And one of the passages we're going to look at tomorrow, for those of you that are going to be here, is Proverbs 31, which has been a passage I've returned to a lot over the years. But today we're going to look at cultural voices on womanhood. This is going to really be an examination of the influences that we are under, and the girls that we have contact with are under. So today is going to be fairly theoretical, I'm afraid. We're going to try and understand the context that we're teaching in. Tomorrow, I'm going to be looking at biblical womanhood, and that is going to be far more practical. So those of you that have signed up for today, but not tomorrow, there'll be full text for tomorrow as well, so you can pick that up and see what happened with that. And the other thing about myself is that I have also been involved in teaching for about 30 years in the primary sector, and have seen how the ideas in our culture have gradually filtered into school in some subtle and other not subtle ways, particularly through things like PSHE in primary school. So we'll be referring to that. Okay. So, to get on with the introduction, I will be referring to my notes a lot, so I do apologise if you don't get a lot of eye contact from me, but we'll see how we go. So, it's been said that never before in our history have we been so eager and to tear up the blueprint of biology and redefine our roles as men and women, mothers and fathers. I suspect that the subject today has been chosen because of the confusion that's resulted from this paradigm shift in our culture and its effect on identity and relationships in our churches and families. The approach we are taking is threefold: to understand the culture, to expose the culture, and then tomorrow to redeem the culture. In this session we will deal with the first two issues. There should be a W in that too. by seeking to understand and expose the way our culture thinks about girls and women. Tomorrow, we will redeem, restore, recover the high calling that God has given to girls and women by exploring God's purpose and design in the Bible, and consider how we can pass on to the next generation the true message of liberation or freedom. Just to go back there to our culture, one of the things that I've been reading recently is a book called Toxic Childhood by Sue Palmer, who is an ex-head teacher, and she examines all the influences that she could explore into what has gone wrong with childhood, and some of her findings are now being fed into a government project which is looking into the same thing. And there's someone quoted in her book, I haven't put the quote down here, but I'll just tell you about it, that we will actually have reached true freedom in this particular area when we even stop asking the question at the birth of a child, is it a boy or is it a girl, as if that makes any difference to anything. And so that's a rather extreme statement, but I think it's illustrative of the confusion that there is. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is try and understand the women's movement or feminism. And the reason we're doing this is that the youngsters, the girls, the women in our churches and in our youth groups are impacted by this, whether we go along with feminist ideology or not. Our culture has been impacted heavily, and so that's why we're seeking to understand. So, first of all, a very potted history lesson. The agent for change in the 21st century was the women's movement. Some would trace its origins to the 18th century Enlightenment. Reason was pitted in battle against religion, and reason won, to all intents and purposes. For example, the political and philosophical writings of Voltaire and Rousseau found an echo among an oppressed and neglected populace and resulted in the social turmoil of the French Revolution. Liberty, fraternity, and equality became the slogan for the masses as they overturned the social order in France and dismantled the traditional structures of the nation. A direct attack on the power and corruption of the church, alongside the sweeping away of the ruling classes, led to a de-Christianization of society and the centrality of the state. The same impact has been felt across the globe as other thinkers such as Hegel and Marx have joined the fray and has led to an increasing secularization, particularly in the West. Politics, not religion, was the new salvation. Well, so much for the potted history lesson, but what relevance has it got to us in seeking to understand our times? Well, the link is an eight-letter word, equality. The politics that surround this idea and the egalitarian belief system that has developed from it are clearly defined in much of the revolutionary rhetoric which found its way into the women's movement. Let's take a closer look at its appeal. What does the word equality, what does the meaning of the word equality convey to us? Well, you may have other things you could add to this list, but these are the ones that I could think of. Equality is associated with fairness, inclusiveness, sameness, balance, and justice. And conversely, inequality is associated with unfairness, exclusiveness or exclusivity, difference, imbalance, and injustice. Well, looking at that list, we would want to align ourselves with the list on the left. They're good ideals. To campaign to establish for such ideals on behalf of everyone, including women, can't be wrong. It's not difficult to find examples of injustice against women, from the wife and mother who feels isolated and taken for granted on the one hand, to the victim of domestic abuse on the other. The oppression of women by men is well documented. Sorry, I thought I was muddled there, but it was right. And there's a quote here from Sharon James, if any of you have read God's Design for Women. Throughout history, men have tyrannized women, whether by wife-beating, polygamy, rape, or forced prostitution. There are records through the ages of women being raped by conquering armies, but the worst instances have probably taken place in this century. Equality and justice are important to us as human beings. the call for women to have the same rights as men seems a reasonable response to the mistreatment of women and the abuse of power by men through the ages. The sincere feminist, then, was concerned to see an end to injustice and oppression in the world. Their cause was about the welfare of women and children and social justice. This was to be achieved through protest, petition, and persuasion, leading to a change in public policy. Excuse all the alliteration. It seems to come several times, actually, in this. I'm going to stop there for a moment and see if there's anybody would like to feed into that first section, understanding the women's movement or feminism. We're trying to understand the mindset because it has taken hold. It only takes hold because there are ideas that are appealing to people. So that's what we've been looking at there. Is there anyone who'd like to comment or contribute something they think is missing there, or anything to add to the list of meanings for equality that you think might illuminate things a little more? Shall I carry on? Okay. So secondly, we're going to look at exposing the women's movement or feminism. The corruption of good intentions. The dawning of the 20th century saw a trickle of female assertiveness become a flood during the 1960s and result in a tsunami of legislation in the 1980s and 90s. And you can find that out if you Google the Equal Opportunities Commission. You can find a list, and it's very clear there. You can see how legislation has filtered through, and in the 1980s was a great welter of it. We'll come back to that in a minute. The process is still ongoing. It was not long before equality with men turned into independence from men. We've already seen how the writings of philosophers in the 18th century influenced the popular mind and resulted in social and political upheaval through the identifying of the real injustices of the time. In the same way, the women's movement focused on legitimate grievances that became a tool for an attack on the role of men and then an attempt to displace them altogether. The first casualty of this approach, of course, was the institution of marriage. It is here that the objectives of some in the feminist movement and followers of Marxist ideals found a unity of purpose. Power games. Since the publication of The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir, 1949, the history of the female sex has been rewritten. The impact of this publication, along with The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan and The Female Eunuch by Germaine Greer and others, reached popular consciousness in the 1960s. Women were told that they must be liberated from the shackles of patriarchal rule and male expectations. As the voice of the women's movement grew louder, concern over the actions of some men turned into a hatred of all men. What began as an attempt by some to develop a just and happy society turned into a battle of the sexes and a concerted attempt to overturn the social order. Men had held power for quite long enough. Women should claim the privileges that men had always enjoyed. The power of men was used abusively. The world would be a better place if women took the lead. The culture of dependency had to be broken. These ideas have increasingly shaped public policy and practice. Erin Pizzi describes her experience in early gatherings of the women's liberation movement in the 1970s. The Guardian gave details of how to contact this new exciting liberation movement for women, so I phoned the main number in London and was directed to my local group in Chiswick. I was less than impressed to find myself in a very big house, hosted by a small woman with a very sharp tongue. If I thought I was going to join a movement that was going to lessen my isolation with my two small children, I was wrong. Your problem is not isolation, I was told. Your problem is your husband. He oppresses you. We were told to call ourselves a collective and refer to each other as comrades. What I saw were groups of left-leaning, white, middle-class women gathering together to hate men. She later went on to do a lot of work, as you know, with women who had been abused, and she set up refuges. And she also published her experiences and did some research into the incidence of domestic violence and found that women were actually as violent as men. And when she started to publish her findings and speak at meetings and be called for consultation with various bodies, she was ostracized for saying so, for saying that, that actually in her experience some women were as violent as men. And so she actually began to be very, began as a very sympathetic thinker, but her experiences led her to think that the women's liberation movement was actually working to another agenda, actually wasn't interested in truth, it was interested in following through a particular line of thinking. So the undermining of family and marriage. The attack on marriage was astonishingly successful. The popularizing of the idea that married women were an oppressed minority, that domesticity was degrading, motherhood was a burden, and all men were users, took root and grew. Women were persuaded that the way out of this depressing life was to find their worth in the same place as men, the workplace. This would give them not only real status and a stimulating social life, but also provide financial independence from men. In 1999, a book was published by influential feminist academics that was called Closing the Gender Gap. James Tooley, who has written a book called The Miseducation of Women, in which he charts his own journey, really, as a person who was very sympathetic to the ideals of the women's movement, but then realized that the impact that feminism was having on girls in particular was not what he thought liberation was going to lead to. And so having been a male teacher who actively encouraged girls to think in a particular way, he completely changed his mind. And the book that he's written, The Miseducation of Women, details his own journey, but also just how much the education system has been taken under the influence of this particular way of thinking. The feminists on Closing the Gender Gap, representative of a broad swathe of opinion in feminist education circles and influential on government policy, are pleased that girls, and working class girls in particular, are leaving the domestic sphere of home and hearth and becoming increasingly independent of men through work. The education feminists think that this is the only way girls can gain status. It is only in the world of men, work, the public sphere, that women can find fulfillment and happiness, the same as it is for boys and men. So what were the social consequences of some of this? Well, we're well aware of some of them. They weren't evident at first. When these ideas were first being put forward, it looked like a brave new world. And it took some time for some of the indicators we're going to look at to happen. Now, it's a big jump from saying women should find their fulfillment in work to saying the social consequences are this list here. So there's a bit of a jump between these two paragraphs. But over a period of time, there were dramatic rises in the divorce rate, family breakup, cohabitation, illegitimacy, absent fathers, the acceptance of casual sex as a leisure activity, the epidemic of STDs, juvenile crime rates, violence, insecurity, mental illness, including self-harm and depression in young girls, to name but a few. Melanie Phillips comments on the impact of feminist ideology on public financial policy and its consequences, particularly for the family, which is getting nearer to where we're trying to think. The government has thrust children forward as its shield of moral valour. Yet the interests of children are best served if their natural parents are married. The poverty of children is significantly caused by their parents' failure to remain so. Behind its child-centred rhetoric, The Labour government is actively discriminating against the one family structure that actually benefited children, pretending to a false even-handedness while creating instead a feminized model of the family that is making men literally and metaphorically redundant. She goes on to say that it's not just academia that has been captured by gender feminism, it has become embedded in the Labour Party just when the intellectual tide is turning against it. It's hard to find a female Labour MP who will disagree with it, at least in public. As a creed, its trajectory in Britain is strikingly similar to the Marxism from which it sprang. Now, she has highlighted the Labour Party because obviously they are the party in power, and so she's looking at the public policy that it is put in place. But actually, I think reading the Conservative Party documents now, you could interchange. That could be Conservative too, because this, you would not challenge this mindset. It is kind of so well embedded. So, in the decades since its inception, feminist ideology has, of course, developed and changed. Clashes of emphasis and personality have produced many brands of feminism. However, they largely fall within two groupings: equality or rationalist feminism, and liberal or celebratory feminism. Again, I'm going to quote James Tooley. Greer says that whether it be old feminism, new feminism, radical feminism, cultural feminism, postmodern feminism, post-structuralist feminism, gender feminism, or lesbian feminism, to name but a few, one's feminist ideas may be usefully categorized as falling into one of these two categories. Well now, what relevance does this have for us today? You may feel it's rather a tired subject, that things have settled down after the extremes of the initial debate in the 60s and 70s, and it's time we moved on. It has been suggested that at the beginning of the 21st century, the movement known as feminism has fragmented. The dream of a united sisterhood had never come to pass. Indeed, the tabloids were able to revel in vicious infighting between supposed sisters. The so-called sameness feminism of the 60s was soon taken over by the difference feminism of the 80s, i.e. women were the superior sex, and there is now a major backlash against feminist ideas in the 90s. It is now said that we live in a post-feminist era. So why are we bothering with this when we're just trying to reach women and girls with the gospel?
Can I ask, what are
sure.
the two different types of feminism that we're categorising these into?
It is the equality feminism. equality feminism, essentially, I mean, in a sentence, is that there is no difference between men and women. So with equality feminism, you do not want to give girls dolls and boys tanks to play with, because boys and girls should be brought up gender neutral. So you don't recognise any difference. You treat them both the same, and you want girls to have access to all the jobs that traditionally would be boys' jobs, because there's no difference between the sexes. Okay, there are secular writers that challenge that view, not just Christian writers. Brain Sex, in the book list at the end of the sheet that you have, one of the books, the Brain Sex by Anne Moore and David Jekyll, outlines the research that has been done that contradicts equality feminism, but essentially that's what it was. The liberal feminists kind of have come along out of equality feminism and saying, actually, we are different, there is a difference, we're not the same, we're not equal, because actually girls are better. So can you hear the difference there? So we must celebrate feminism, we celebrate womanhood. We're actually further along in the evolutionary process than the men. So we must celebrate our greatness, really. Is that okay? Is that answered?
Yeah.
Is there anything else before? Would anyone like to question the big jump that we made? Because we did.
I just want to say, Mel wrote back and it was saying about how in schools they sort of encourage girls to kiss. I'm sort of thinking, isn't that right? Do you know what I mean? Because it might be, like, I mean, I obviously haven't really heard this sort of thing before, but that school that, you know, boys and girls should be given the same opportunities.
Yeah.
Because obviously, like that, I mean, even amongst ourselves here, you might want to become lawyers or doctors or, and are sort of intellectually capable and also very. You sort of need women in those things. When you think of like women doctors who are like amazing and done amazing things, almost like, do you know what I mean? I don't know if this was suggesting that.
No, I think we actually come to that as well. So if we carry on and then that question is still in your mind when we've looked at education, come back to me. Okay, but it may be that we answer some of those as we go along. Thank you. Any other comments? Okay. Well, the reason that I'm talking about this is that I think the reason we need to understand what's happened in the past is that it has shaped the way that girls and women think about themselves in the present. The author quoted above goes on to say, popular thinking is still conditioned by the discredited notion that men and women are basically the same, equality feminism in other words. People are nervous of comments about men and women that might be construed as sexist. It is still said that any difference between the sexes are probably only the result of societal conditioning. So how did this happen? Well, there are two major ways in which this way of thinking was embedded. One is the state education system, and the other was public policy and equality legislation. And from now on, it's really equality feminism that plays the biggest part. So the social order had to be changed by changing the attitudes of the young on a mass scale. The advocates of feminism were not content with winning over the intellectual elite and chattering classes. Nothing less than the liberation of the ordinary woman in the street would fulfill their ambitions. The best place to accomplish this was in the school. James Tooley observes that it is the themes of the early Greer, Steinem, and Friedan that independence and career are what are most important to a girl, that marriage, children, and family are just so much domestic drudgery that match the curriculum and emphasis of schooling for girls today. And just as Betty Friedan realized in the feminine mystique, it is mainly through their schooling that women and girls can escape the limitations of discrimination and reach their full potential. And he refers to the American sex discrimination law of 1972 and says the prejudices of the early Betty Friedan and the early Gloria Steinem were all there, spelled out in legislative detail to ensure gender neutrality that emphasizes over and over again that the only way to success and fulfillment for women is through achievement in the worlds of business, science, sport, and politics. The family does not get a look in here. The gender-neutral curriculum was born. The Sexual Discrimination Act of 1975 enshrines the same objectives in UK law. The Education Reform Act of 1988 embedded this feminist worldview in the national curriculum and assessment systems, although it was very evident within the education system before that, but this actually made it even more explicit and enforced it by law because every teacher has to teach it within the state system. The introduction of PSAT and citizenship education in 2000 has reinforced the same agenda. I was involved with a teacher consultation process with something called the Passport Project in 1999, which fed into the citizenship curriculum that was then introduced. And the writers of the Passport Project, as it was called, definitely had this agenda in mind. And it is equality feminism that they were after. You must not have not recognize any difference between boys and girls in the way that you teach, in what you teach, in your expectations, do not recognize any differences. Now, we'll come back in a second to aspirations for girls, because that is important. Because we do have aspirations for girls, we're not criticizing that. So, to move on to some conclusions, why is this important? Well, for two reasons. Because all the girls who have been educated with our state schools for the last 30 years have been exposed to this teaching and shaped by it. And secondly, because it has not moved with the times. Let's look at the first point. The gender neutral curriculum has pervaded all subjects. It is impossible to avoid it. The subliminal nature of its assumptions make it very difficult to resist. Amy Jenkins, creator of This Life, wrote in the Daily Mail last week, "The best kept secret of my generation, how great it is to have a baby. I reached the cutting edge of my teenagedom in the early 1980s, and I and my friends who came from liberal middle-class families, our parents were mostly in the media, were well-schooled in the drawbacks of early pregnancy. Our feminist mothers knew only too well that having babies young would hold us back in our careers. Our mother's generation seemed particularly concerned we shouldn't fall into the trap of being all gooey about babies. They had in mind the stultifying atmosphere of the 50s, against which they had rebelled in the 60s. She goes on to describe a very Stepford Wives kind of extreme view of what being a housewife meant, which was actually pure Simone de Beauvoir. That's exactly what she was attacking in her publications. No teacher or parent I knew would ever talk to us about the joy of being a mother, the amount of love it brings into your life, together with a sense of purpose and meaning. No. They talked to us about the terrible weight of responsibility that parenthood was, the pain of childhood, the loss of freedom, the sleepless nights, the destruction of career prospects, the loss of power, and the dependence on men. I made a vow to myself I would never have a baby. At my comprehensive school, we were very politicized about contraception and abortion. We all went off to the newly formed Brooke Advisory Center at the faintest whiff of sex, but it was a mark of coolness to go on the pill, even if you didn't need to. In her 30s, she married and began to tire of the rat race and started to long for a family, and she now has a young son called Arthur. Now, I've chosen to quote her from that very recent article, because it shows the power of what the effect of what was being taught in that. That's the impact it had on her and her friends. I was in secondary school, senior school in the late 60s. And so it was in the early days of all of this, but it certainly came through to my school. Mm-hmm. And so by the time she was in school in the 80s, it was well embedded. In arguing against equality feminism, we are in danger of appearing to support oppression and injustice. Christian girls, or any girls who want to resist it, cannot keep their guard up all the time and may struggle to think biblically about men and their leadership. But it is interesting that even secular writers and thinkers are now questioning the assumptions that underlie this. But of course, now that it's gone into the education system, which is not a flexible system, it's a bureaucratic system, it's become frozen in time. We now have equality feminism frozen into the system. It's not flexible because systems are not flexible. So even though people are questioning the assumptions, it's going to be a long time before that comes out in the classroom. So on the second point, we're not moving on in our thinking as a culture. Because of the Sexual Discrimination Act and the National Curriculum, we were heavily influenced by equality feminists. It reflects their objectives at that time. Since then, Frieden, Greer and others have reviewed and retracted some of their earlier statements, especially about motherhood and homemaking, and lamented the loss of the things that they despised and undermined. Even Simone de Beauvoir, the second sex has been rewritten, reread and reinterpreted. And again, we quote James Tooley. Betty Friedan moved on from her ideas in the second stage, recognizing that women need families, indeed could find the fulfillment of their need for power and security within the family. De Beauvoir was torn between denigrating domesticity, which he had to do perhaps for ulterior motives, and delighting in it. Germaine Greer's The Whole Woman seems to fit neatly into this camp too. The alternative women's voices raise wonder why we need, through education, to create women who are restless and questing, and whether it might not be better to create a society in which women are happy and fulfilled. They now lean towards celebrating the differences between the sexes and the unique role that women can fulfill. But it is too late to regret. Laws are not that easily repealed. Two generations of girls have marched to a different tune. Some commentators are now saying that feminism has not only been bad for men and children, but disastrous for women. Independence from men has only led to dependence on the state for some. The freedom to pursue a career has led to exhaustion and emptiness. There has been a rise in violence and drinking among young girls who are behaving like boys. The casual use of sex has encouraged men to use women and then leave them with no guilt attached. The ignoring of sexual differences has led to confusion and frustration. The trail of destruction left in the wake of the feminist juggernaut is endless. And in the book on brain sex, they comment, men are different from women. They are equal only in their common membership of the same species, humankind. To maintain that they are the same is to build a society based on a biological and scientific lie. In her book, Sex Change Society, Melanie Phillips concludes that men need work, women need choice, i.e. whether to work outside the home or not. Children need both parents. Government policies should not promote a sex change society. They should support the sensitive and complex networks of independence between men and women. Without such reinforcement, a serious hole will remain at the heart of any welfare reform and of society itself. We are adrift, as someone else has said, in a sea of confusion over our sexual roles, and life is not the better for it. So much for the twists and turns of our culture on the issue of what it means to be a girl or a woman. We've sought to understand feminism and expose its assumptions. Those of you that are here tomorrow will seek to redeem the subject. How should we teach the next generation about womanhood? How can we restore God's order and purpose in our lives and theirs? And what does true womanhood look like? How are we to influence the next generation of girls to live God-centered, Christ-exalting, Bible-saturated lives? So, we'll come back to your question. And also discuss it. It'd be interesting to get some input on that. All we have done there is seek to look at, it's quite theoretical, but seek to look at why we are where we are now and what influences have impacted not just the girls that we're dealing with, but their mothers, and in some cases their grandmothers. I'm a grandmother now, and these things happened during my education as well. And the reason that's important is that when we're coming to teach the Bible to girls, we need to think about the mindset that has already been put in place for them, whether they're Christian girls from Christian homes or girls from homes that don't come near church. There is a mindset that we're dealing with. And when we're bringing truth to that mindset, we need to understand what kind of resistance we might meet to what we're saying. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, we might need to explore issues like, if boys and girls are different, should we be recognising that in the way that we deal with them in our children and youth work? Certainly in our church, we don't. We deal with everybody the same. But it may be that we need to be kind of thinking a little bit more laterally on that kind of area. So those are the kinds of thoughts that we might follow through on. But to return to your question on education, is it wrong then to have aspirations for girls? I have some thoughts, but I'd like anybody else to contribute. if you feel free to.
I think your comment about it's important for men to work and women to have choice, and certainly in my married life I've seen that to be true. I trained as a chartered accountant and I've got lots of qualifications, but my choice was to work part-time and then serve in my church, and my mum found that quite difficult in that, she just said, you had all this money on your education, but in my view, education is to give you a choice, not to make you go down a road that you don't necessarily want to go down. So I think education is fine because it gives choice, but then if you then take away the choice to not do what your education has told you should do, then that's not really choice at all. So
Mm.
And also, I think in school, being a mother isn't presented as an option.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm a careers advisor, and so obviously going to school and do group work and talk about careers and what you're going to be and all of that type of stuff. And I had a group work assessed by my assessor, who challenged me afterwards because one of the girls said to me, I actually would quite like to be a mum. And don't really have any ideas about what I want to do as a career. To me, that's the job I quite like, and I want to have a family and a husband. And so I said to her, that's brilliant, and that's something that you should, if that's what you want, but you also do need to kind of think laterally about things. Obviously, you can't plan into the future and say, I am going to be a mother either. So it's probably quite helpful to just kind of explore and look into what you were like so you can kind of, blah blah. One of the things my assessor picked me up on was the fact that I actually said that was a viable option, that being a mum and a was something that they could pursue.
So your assessor, a man or a woman?
Man. Yeah. And I have to kind of pick up all of the whole things about, you can't say policeman and you can't say dustman and you can't say, it has to be, police officer, refuse collector.
It's gender neutral.
Yeah.
Terms all the time.
Yeah. Mm. And actually, it's normally, it'll be the kids that say, oh, but that's stupid, miss. Girls don't want to be plumbers and,
Got more common sense.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
I think it's quite interesting to meet. We started off talking about the ideals that then got corrupted, because I don't think many of us would have too many problems with the original ideals that women shouldn't be beaten up and raped, and if they're doing exactly the same job as a man then they should get paid the same for it. I don't think any of us have a problem with that, but I think I find it really worrying, going through all this kind of thing. It makes me really cross, and I feel really sorry for men when I read this. I think about all the men I know who are absolutely fantastic and amazing, and I read this and I think, that is so unfair.
Mm.
It's just horrible. And I'm just about to leave things for tomorrow's topic, but I think one thing that really jumped out at me, in the top of page 9, talks about women fulfilling their need for power.
Mm.
And I thought, need for power. And how the gospel reflects on that. And I know that's probably a sort of tomorrow's session kind of topic, but that really kind of lets me out, that really.
Mm.
I think the values, like you said, are very, they are quite Bible-centred, that God wanted people to treat deeply. But I just think when you leave godly values in ungodly people's hands, and they mess them up, the roles that God created were within those values, and that sinful man has, and women, or sinful humankind, and it just says that God's order and roles are right, and when we try and change them and do stuff with them, we just get it wrong, we're then kind of changing things back to how they should be, and it just shows what a mess we make things, good things, and we can.
Yes, at the very beginning we were looking at the de-Christianisation of the West in particular.
Right.
Obviously that happened in the French Revolution for France,
yeah.
But it has impacted, hasn't it, right through. And one of, I don't know if you're familiar with the writings of Douglas Wilson, who's done a lot of work on education of children and what worldview we're actually giving them. But he says that God is the unifying principle of all knowledge. All knowledge comes from him and returns to him. It's the unifying principle, holds it all together. That means that when you are learning within the context of a God-centered worldview, all subjects connect because they're connected in him. So you're not just studying science or history or geography. Everything is interconnected. You can join the dots, actually, across. But once you get a secular education system or a secular mindset or worldview in society, you've cut off the unifying principle. So everything, all subjects, are kind of left wobbling around on their own kind of base, which is what you've got here. You've got the secularization of society. And once you have that, then meaning and purpose and the cohesion of society is actually quite fragile. So in a way, feminism and secularization, feminism is just a kind of product of that, isn't it? Once you cut God out of the picture. But of course, tomorrow we'll be looking at what happens when God is in the picture, as you say.
I find it quite interesting, you know, that scientific evidence is now coming through that shows that, apart from kind of genitalia, women and men are actually different in that their minds are different, because I'm very much a woman, and I think I've kind of grown into that almost, but I also have a lot of masculine traits. I had cars when I was younger. I chose to play with cars. I chose to play with kind of the Technic Lego rather than the kind of building the doll's house kind of Lego.
Mm.
And I did maths and physics as my kind of subject.
Mm.
Kind of quite a masculine mindset, and I find that quite strange, because my brother, partly possibly because he had two older sisters, you know, liked playing dressing up, liked playing kind of with us when we were doing Barbies
mm.
and things. And yet he has grown up into wanting to do business, whereas I've grown up into wanting to be involved in family and in working with young people.
Mm.
And I find it strange trying to, I suppose, see how as young people, as kind of children, in fact, we were actually very similar in our likes and our dislikes.
Mm.
But we've kind of grown into our masculinity and femininity, if you like, as we've got older, despite this
mm.
equality feminism being ingrained in schools.
Mm. And of course, one of the reactions that we're seeing, and the government is very worried about, is that you've got all of this happening in school and in the media, and you have this reinforced there too. One of the actions to it is that girls want babies. They're kind of being pushed towards this, but actually they want that. And so you've got a rise in teenage pregnancies, and that quite apart from the rise in abortion as well. You've got sure babies being aborted, but you've still got teenage pregnancy being a big issue, which has fallen slightly, I think, in the last results that came out, but it's still the highest in Europe. So there's something going on there, isn't there, in terms of what girls are kind of tending towards in spite of being pushed
yeah.
this way. Now, it'd be simplistic to say that there's one reason for that. There'd be
mm-hmm.
lots of reasons for that. But it is an interesting observation. And one of the things we'll look at tomorrow, for those of you that are here tomorrow, is the romanticism that is growing as a kind of reaction against feminism.
Mm.
What we've got here, particularly in the 1980s feminism, is quite hard, isn't it? It's not very tender at all. And as a reaction to it, we've got lots of girl flicks and things like that, kind of romantic views of life, kind of updated Jane Austen kind of views. So we'll look at that a bit tomorrow. But tomorrow will be far more practical than today. There's something I was going to say about education, and it's having a senior moment. I'll tell you something first of all about one experience, and hope that it comes to my mind as I'm talking. One of the things I did when I was still working in the state system was that I was involved in the Health Promoting Schools project, and I thought, in my naivety, it was going to be about healthy eating and exercise and you know, healthy lifestyle and everything. And I didn't realise until I'd done it all, great big folder of things and, you know, met all the criteria and everything, and somebody came to assess it for, who was actually working with the Education Authority and with the Health Authority. So she bridged the both and she came and she was the assessor. Looked through, she flicked straight through anything to do with food and exercise and all the other things we're doing. She honed in on our schools council, the fact that we had a male headmaster, and the anti-bullying policy. That it, they were political things she was looking for. And she said to me, "Oh, I noticed with your school's council that the children vote, but they vote for a boy and a girl from each class. Don't you think that's a bit separatist?" Now, separatist wasn't, I wasn't quite sure what was getting out there, but she obviously didn't like the idea that boys had a vote and girls had, you know, we had a boy and a girl represent each class because there were boys and girls in each class, funnily enough. And so I said, "Well, would you be happy then if all the people that were voted onto the school's council were boys, or we had a majority of boys, if we didn't have that kind of, you know, split vote?" And she looked quite surprised, because what she was thinking was that if you got rid of, you can vote for a boy and you can vote for a girl, that we'd have all girls on the school council. She hadn't actually thought that. Oh, crumbs, they might actually want boys on the school council. But it was a criticism of what we'd done. But she then went on to comment on the fact that we had a head teacher who was a man. And of course, you know, she made a very sexist, actually, remark about him. But the other thing that she criticised us for was that in our anti-bullying policy, we did not specifically mention homophobic bullying in key stage 1 and 2, which we were going to do over my dead body. But she pointed that out as part of our, you know, assessment, that she was going to make a note of that. Now, it got through anyway. The whole process was interesting because, under the guise of looking at a healthy lifestyle, what was really happening was a very strong political agenda. And when I've kept in touch with what's happening with PSHE curriculum, because I think that is a flashpoint for us as Christians. That's where you can actually see what's going on. I'm having another senior moment. The Health Promoting Schools project is always brought into the PSHE curriculum, and schools have been encouraged to sign up to it. And if you see a little logo saying HPA, Health Promoting Awards, at the bottom of a school letter, they've been through this process too, and it's actually not what it looks like. It's about this kind of stuff coming into school from the very earliest age. So, there's a website I'd like to recommend to you, because it touches on these areas and will give you an insight into what's happening with your youngsters in your group. If you Google the Campaign for Real Education, they have an excellent paper on PSHE on their website. And for those of you that are teachers, if you're not aware of that website, it also has very good papers on every subject area that you're teaching. It's not a Christian website. It's a website which has been put together by people that are very concerned about what is happening in school because of this political agenda. But they're not actually a Christian, so it's a very, very helpful website. But the paper on PSHE is very good.
They've actually taken the H out of my daughter's school on the healthy side of it, and it's just PSE.
Right.
That's right. Hence that healthy eating
holiday. They call it PSHME in my daughter's school, Push Me New School, which included moral, you see. So the agenda is really to... You've got RE over here, which is decided by a body called the SACRE in every area, Standing Advisory Council for Religious Education. They decide what's taught in our ENA area. So RE has always been kind of over there. You've got the national curriculum here and then RE. Yeah. So what's happening is that, and has been happening over some years now, is that the PSHE, PSE, PSHME, whatever the initials, is gradually pushing RE out because it demands curriculum time. I think it's 5% RE. Well, and I think it's 5% PSHE.
But it's increased, though, with citizenship.
In Key Stage
and
3 and 4,
yes.
And PSHE is not compulsory in Key Stage 1 and 2. But if you're not doing it, it's going to put you down in your Ofsted report. So it's not compulsory, but. Whereas citizenship definitely is compulsory from 3 and 4. And that's where these things are really being really pushed. So you need to be aware of that with children. But look at that website, because that paper is very helpful and insightful. How are we doing on time? I think we've
at half past.
Right, okay. Is there anything... I haven't actually answered the question about aspirations.
Okay, I guess the paper's not really... Because I guess I was just sort of thinking about when my mum went to school and she was really bright, but she ended up going to school and she's only taught domestic things. And, like, I say, it's the same... So this paper isn't really suggesting that in schools boys and girls shouldn't have an equal right to the same opportunity, but they should just have a choice.
Mm.
It's
mm-hmm.
not saying, like, oh, we don't think girls should be able to achieve A.
Mm. We've kind of reversed the situation now. What seems to have happened now is that we've experienced a feminization of the curriculum. Another thing that James Tooley points out is that the national curriculum is a feminized curriculum. And that would appear to be supported by the results we're getting, that girls are overtaking boys all over the place and in subjects that are traditionally boys' subjects. And that has to do with the way that they are being taught and the way they are being assessed. Girls are far better, by and large. Now, there are exceptions, and one of our daughters is one of the exceptions. But by and large, girls like coursework, and they do very well with coursework. By and large, boys hate coursework, and they do very well with exams. The kind of, you know, last-minute cramming and getting into the exam hall and pouring it all out, and boys do better with that. So what kind of assessment system do we have? Well, largely coursework. And the way that things are taught in small groups, collaborative learning, lots of discussion, they're not ways
sharing
boys
your emotional
learn.
Reaction to things.
Yes. That's not how boys work, is it?
In the name, why do I do sweet? I need to take PSL about it.
Yeah.
Because I think.
And actually, PSHE is very, very feminized.
Mm.
I don't know if you heard of circle time
yeah.
and that kind of thing. That is not a place that a boy usually will feel comfortable and going around the circle and telling everybody how you're feeling that day. You know, I went to courses on this and was horrified by what I was hearing. And when I asked questions about where the dividing line is between being a teacher and being a therapist, I wasn't very popular.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it's like an encounter group in class. Now, most teachers are not qualified to do that, on the one hand, but also it is very bent towards the way that girls mm-hmm. relate mm-hmm. and not the way that boys relate.
But also, feminine in Key Stage, counselling in Key Stage 1, with Key Stage 1 and even Key Stage 2 age kids, it's not done by talking with them often. It's done by play therapy. Mm. I mean, I had a brother who's had to go through kind of that sort of camp. He couldn't have talked about it.
Mm.
He didn't know how to talk about it.
Mm.
He just didn't have the words.
Mm.
I think he didn't even know how consciousness of what it was actually he wanted to talk about, even before trying to find the words. And it's only through the kind of the play therapy kind of stuff, which they're probably pushing out, the kind of playtime mm. in the afternoon, to kind of put this stuff in, that
mm.
you're able to express yourself mm. like that.
But you can see how successful feminist thinking has been
yeah.
In
yeah.
impacting mm-hmm. the way that particularly the school's work, even down to a very, very young age. You do circle times in year one, I think, in the school that I was in. We even did them in reception. But tomorrow we will be more positive. It's been quite negative this afternoon. But we need to know the setting that the children are in. I think that a lot of parents are unaware of the setting that children are in. And in all innocence are leaving their children at the school gate every morning thinking that they're doing the best thing. Now, it may be that they can't do anything else but do that because they are both working or that the circumstances cannot permit any other kind of schooling to take place. But we parents do need to be aware of what is happening so that they can equip their children. Because I think there are a lot of children going into this quite defenceless. And it may be that as children's workers and youth workers, there is a task to be achieved in helping parents and helping children to face these pressures. Now, one of the best antidotes to error is truth. And tomorrow we're going to look at truth. So I look forward to that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Certainly. very, very few of the people who are teaching in the churches are going to be aware of any of it at all. So the teaching part is very, very liquid. The use of words, the gender neutral it's no wonder that teenage girls, well, certainly the teenage girls that you know, I talked to about sermons we had last year, find it very, very, very difficult. And I've worked hard over many years to try and listen to
get
there. And I'm thinking, actually, we've got
we do.
It's not that we've got
to
put one to these places that are going to be
complicated.
We've just got to be aware of the fact this is how people are
learning.
The
other
thing is, thinking about that, because of a discussion group,
we can't really do that.
It's also very delicate.
We set up
our
youth system often.
She's still in that.
It's more good than is that actually, because feminized education, how are we actually living
off
our men? Are they actually being aged out of
the church?
And also, by people,
not yet.
There's historical reasons for that as well.
It is appalling.
You know,
and then you've got that happening on the one hand.
Majority of attending the church is being
I